This is Interviews, a podcast from the National Academy of Sciences that provides first-person accounts of the lives and work of Academy members. In this series of one-on-one conversations, scientists talk about what inspired them to pursue the careers they chose and describe some of the most fascinating aspects of their research. Linda Bartoshuk's scientific trajectory has taken her from the stars to the senses. As a kid in Aberdeen, South Dakota, Bartoshuk traced the constellations in the night sky and dreamed of becoming an astronomer. Despite teachers' encouragement to pursue more quote-unquote realistic goals, like becoming a secretary or housewife, Bartoshuk bartered for high school and math classes and then went off to college to study the universe. But when she learned that 1950s astronomy didn't welcome women, she signed up for a psychology class on a whim and found her calling. As an experimental psychologist, Bartoshuk has discovered unexpected links between human health and the sense of taste. Her work has shown that inhibitory processes, mechanisms that suppress pain, for example, underlie taste perception, and that nerve damage resulting from disease, trauma, or chemotherapy can release that inhibition, causing pain or distorted taste. She was also the first to identify supertasters, people who have an unusually high number of taste buds and experience tastes more intensely than their fellow eaters. Her current research focuses on the connections between taste damage and obesity, and on more accurate methods for comparing taste or pain experiences across people. Bartoshuk is a professor of community dentistry and behavioral sciences in the University of Florida's College of Dentistry in Gainesville. She was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 2003.
My name is Linda Bartoshuk. I'm an experimental psychologist, and I do research on the sense of taste and oral pain. I grew up in Aberdeen, South Dakota. And when I was a child, the population of Aberdeen was about 25,000. It's actually shrunk since then. It was third largest city in South Dakota at the time. I went back for my high school reunion, and the place just seemed like a village. It was probably a pretty typical Midwestern town. It was very, very flat. But the city was actually located in a slight depression in the ground, and it meant that we saw a lot of tornadoes, and they skipped over the town. So one of my most vivid memories as a kid is sitting on the front porch watching the funnel clouds and then watching them skip and go over our town.
What did your parents do?
My mom was a housewife, and my dad worked for Saucony Mobile. He installed gas stations, painted tanks, did everything you had to do to get a gas station up and running.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
I had an older brother. Unfortunately, he died some years ago. He was 9 years older than me. So the truth is, it was almost like being an only child, because he had left and gone into the Army about the time when I would have really remembered him.
When did you first become interested in science?
I don't remember any time that I wasn't interested in science. As a kid, I used to go into the vacant lot next to our house with a picture of the constellations and pick out the stars, learned all the names and the constellations. And from the time I was very small, I wanted to be an astronomer. I don't remember being fascinated by any other kind of science. I just remember the stars, and I grew up loving science fiction, and I thought maybe someday I'd be out there.
In school, do you have any salient memories of getting involved in science or a teacher who made an impact on you?
Well, a little town in South Dakota, there wasn't a lot of enrichment. I mean, it was pretty standard science. I remember always loving it and loving math. And then getting into high school, it was interesting because in high school, my guidance counselor, with the best of intentions, thought that my desire to go into science was unrealistic. I still remember in junior high, we had a career night, and we wrote down what we wanted to be on a card, and our teacher invited people in that profession to come and meet us. And I wrote down astronomer, and I was assigned to interview a secretary. And that was the perception of what my world would be like on the part of very well-meaning teachers. And by the time I got to high school, I was told that I couldn't take the science and math courses, that they basically were closed to women. And I remember bargaining with my guidance counselor, and I agreed to take bookkeeping and typing in return for being allowed to take algebra and chemistry. And then I also took physics, and as I recall, there might have been one other girl in algebra. I don't remember any in chemistry, and certainly none in physics and trigonometry. But what's interesting is they did let me take those courses, even though it was much to the misgiving of everybody. They thought I was very unrealistic.
What was the attitude toward you in those classes?
The teachers were wonderful. We had a teacher, Mr. Oakes, I'll never forget him, and he had no prejudice as far as I could tell at all. I mean, I was treated like one of the guys. But the guidance counselor came from a different generation, different set of rules, but it was just weird. I mean, the impression I got from the teachers was there weren't other women in the class because they didn't want to take it. But if I was weird and wanted to take it, why not? So I thought I would go to engineering school when I got out of high school, and I applied and got into the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. My parents took me there for a visit, and I found out that out of 100 incoming freshmen, there would be 4 females. And I just said, I don't think so. No, 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 no. So I went to Carleton College, and they had an observatory. So I signed up for Carleton.
What did your parents think about you wanting to be in science so badly?
I remember them being pretty disappointed. When I went to college, I know my mom said she wanted me to learn to play bridge and to dance. I never did either one. And I always had a feeling that my family was pretty disappointed in me. They wanted a social butterfly, and they got a nerd.
Did they ever come around?
Oh, I don't know. My father died when I was in college of lung cancer. All that spray painting he did without a mask as a young man. And I never really had a clear picture of whether my mother approved of what I did or not. It didn't much matter because she raised me to be very independent, and she sort of reaped what she sowed, and I grew up to be very independent.
Tell me about being at Carleton College.
When I was at Carleton, I went there in, oh my goodness, 1956. My image of that was that when I saw Greece much later, I realized that my high school years were sort of like Greece, and I was Patty Simcox, the nerd, you know, who always did the weird stuff. Nobody liked her. It wasn't that people were unkind at all. It's just that I didn't fit the high school mold when I went to college. I had been told by my guidance counselor that I could go to college, but I would probably not do well. That I came from a little town in South Dakota, and I would go to Carleton, and I would probably be barely able to make C's, and I should just resign myself to this. I had no expectations, and I started taking the courses I wanted, science, math, and I got A's. And it was a big shock initially. The first 2 years at Carleton were like being a kid in a candy store. I had a wonderful time there. But by the end of my sophomore year, I had come to feel bad about the school. I started out in astronomy and math, and I learned as I started getting more sophisticated that women were not welcomed in astronomy. And I learned there were rules against allowing women to use some of the big telescopes. And this was a great shock to me. I don't think I'd ever come face to face with that kind of discrimination. I never really thought about it much in high school. I just thought the other girls didn't want to do what I was doing. I don't think I really, it's only retroactively that it looks so weird to me. So here I was, last 2 years of Carleton, and didn't want to be an astronomy major anymore. And my Carleton roommate and I sat down one night, I remember going through the catalog, thinking, what could I switch to that I could get enough credit for? And we looked at it, and I thought, English, I'd love to major in English, but I'd lost too much time and didn't have enough prerequisites. And then we looked up psychology. We discovered that if I switched my major to psychology, they would give me credit for all my math and astronomy. I'd basically completed the astronomy major in 2 years. I needed one more course, and I'd taken all this math. So I switched my major to psychology, and the first intro course I took was taught by John Baer, and the man was a charismatic teacher. And he taught about psychophysics. I'd never heard of it before. And this is where you observe sensory experience, and you learn how the senses work in this way. And I just loved it, totally captivated by this field, and switched my major to psychology.
So once you found psychophysics, what happened?
Well, I was off to graduate school, and there was the big shock. I had planned to go to Yale, and I was going to work with a man named Neil Miller. And I had tried to find out something about his lab, and I called him, and he never called back. So I thought, oh, this is not good. I'm getting into something where maybe I'm not going to be welcome again. I'm uneasy about this. And I had an NSF pre-doc fellowship. So at the very last moment, I shifted all my paperwork to Brown University, and I went to work with my undergraduate teacher's mentor. John Baer was one of Carl Fafman's first PhDs, so I went to work with Carl Fafman. Now, I don't know why I didn't decide to do that in the first place. He was in the field of taste. I loved it. But I sort of felt like maybe I shouldn't just follow in my teacher's footsteps. But I got scared off of Yale and ended up switching to my paperwork to Brown. And like a day after I did it, I get a call from Neil Miller. It turns out he's been in Russia with Carl Fafman on an American Psychological Association-sponsored trip. And I am so embarrassed. Who am I, this little, you know, this dumb little undergraduate? And I'm telling him, oh, I decided not to come and work with you. And I was incredibly embarrassed. But as it turned out, it was one of the luckiest decisions of my life. Neil Miller never produced a female PhD. He treated women badly. And women left his lab in droves. Nobody ever finished. So it seems that I made a lucky choice going to Brown. And then I start getting to know Carl Fafman. And he was being wooed in those days. He was a very famous man, member of the National Academy. He was being wooed by Harvard and Yale and Rockefeller, which he ultimately went to. So he wasn't around very much. And he was very uneasy about having me in his laboratory. He told me he didn't want women in his lab. So here I am, right back in it again. He said women were emotional, they had to wash their hair, and there were all kinds of problems. And he'd had a couple of women in his lab that hadn't worked out well. And so he generalized. And so I was no longer acceptable to him. And I felt very bad about this. So I talked to some of my classmates, and the male classmates I had were just rabid about this. They couldn't believe it. They thought it was unfair. So one of them, a guy named Don Aldrich, took me into his office and he said, now I'm going to tell you how to handle Fafman. So you make an appointment and you go back up there, you march into that room and you tell him you came to Brown to work with him and you expect to work with him. I did it. I would go in, do what he told me, and I'd come back and tell him what happened. He'd tell me what to do next. And Fafman developed the serious misimpression that I was different from other women, that I was very aggressive, and that I would do okay, and he let me into his lab. And many years later, Fafman developed a taste disorder, and he became my patient because I understood the disorder he had. He developed a disorder called herpes zostericus. It's the chickenpox virus reactivates and damages cranial nerves. And it got into his auditory nerve. And the auditory nerve is cranial nerve number 8. Well, cranial nerve 7 and cranial nerve 9 are taste nerves. They're right next to it. And the virus moves from the auditory nerve into the taste nerves. So Fafman called me from the hospital and told me what had happened to him and asked me to come and test him. And I can talk in a minute about what we learned because it was absolutely amazing. It opened a whole new chapter in my scientific career. But as we spent a lot of time together over a period of 3 years, we got very close in a way we hadn't been when I was his student actively. And I asked him about those early years, and I asked him how he felt about me in those years and why he was so hard on me. And he expressed amazement that I had any such memories of him at all. He denied ever telling me he didn't want me in his lab. He absolutely insisted he had always seen me as one of his best students. And I was content to let it go. I didn't think we were going to get anywhere, and I do not believe I changed his mind about women. I believe his daughter did. She became a lawyer. And I believe she changed his mind gradually, and his attitudes toward me changed, and he simply recreated our past. Or perhaps I have. Mm-hmm. How do we ever really know? The saddest part about this adventure we had, first let me tell you what happened with the science. At the time Fafman developed his disorder, I had been very interested in the quarter tympani nerve, which is the seventh cranial nerve, and damage to it, and what would happen. I was developing a theory about inhibition among the nerves. And when I tested Fofmann for the first time, I discovered to my amazement that the side where he'd had viral damage was completely devoid of taste. It was gone. Touch was normal, but taste was missing. And on his remaining, the intact side, which was not affected by the disorder, taste was extremely strong. He noticed no change in his whole mouth. Now, this was exciting because our theory had predicted that if you took one nerve out, the other would compensate by going up and whole mouth taste would stay the same. So here I was with a brilliant clinical example of this. So over time, his nerves that were damaged regenerated. And first, taste returned to the back of the affected side, then it slowly began to come forward until eventually he had taste back on all of the nerve fields. And as his taste recovered on the damaged side, it diminished on the intact side. What had happened was taking taste out released inhibition on the other side, and as taste came back, the inhibition faded and taste went back to normal. During all that time, his whole mouth taste was completely normal. So we got to a point where I was careful not to tell him what I thought because I didn't want to ruin him as a subject. But at some point, I wanted him to understand the implications of what we were doing. So I explained it all. And he actually gave a paper at our annual meeting describing his own case. And a year later, he updated it with the results of a whole year's worth of data collection. And we were just getting going, and heaven knows how long we would have kept the study going. And he suffered a massive stroke. Ultimately, it took his life. But he was basically cognitively impaired and couldn't work on the project anymore. I never had the heart to write it up. I never published those data. I've subsequently talked to some of his other students, and we're thinking maybe enough time has passed that we should now write it up. And I actually consulted a historian of psychology, Ludi Benjamin, to ask him if it would be appropriate for me to publish data like that. And his answer is absolutely yes. Yes, we should, because Fofmann would have loved to have had those data published.
How did you first become interested in taste? Why specifically taste?
You know, I was asked that question once when I went back to Brown for some celebration, and there was a banquet. And someone at the banquet got the bright idea. I'd given a lecture, and they said, how did you get interested in taste? And I would have said, oh, it was an accident. I worked with John Baer, and he sent me to work with Fofmann, and they both worked in taste. And I suddenly remembered that my father died of lung cancer, and the worst symptom he had when he had lung cancer was that things didn't taste right. And that flashed into my mind, and I told that anecdote, and I realized that I had been interested in taste for years because of him. Now, nobody understood what was wrong with him, but what is interesting is that that became one of the predominant problems I worked on. Why is taste quality changed during disease? What happens to the nerve to make this happen? And I figured it out. We actually learned, partly through the experiment with Fofmann, how it worked. And so, if I could go back in time, I could have diagnosed my father's symptoms. Tragically, my brother developed liver cancer and also developed a taste distortion. By this time, I knew what it was, and I traveled to his home in Arizona, evaluated him, and I could totally explain what had happened to him. I knew he was having what we call a taste phantom, and so was my father. What happens when you damage one nerve, about 50% of the patients develop a bizarre taste someplace else in their mouth, and we call it a phantom taste because it's like a phantom limb. The taste isn't really there. By that time, I diagnosed it, but I couldn't treat it. A couple years later, we discovered how to treat it. So now I could go back in time, diagnose my father and treat his problem, diagnose my brother and treat his problem. But unfortunately, I didn't know it soon enough. But now I really can go back and help those patients. And it's a group of patients that we can cure some of them, of these horrible phantoms. And we do it because we know the mechanism. It's a central release of inhibition mechanism. You damage taste from one nerve, it releases inhibition on the other nerve, just like we saw with Pfaffman. The release of inhibition in some people is so energetic, it produces a phantom sensation when there's nothing there. We treat it by giving the patient a drug that simulates the inhibition in the taste system and suppresses the phantom. It's the same mechanism for something called burning mouth syndrome. You can get a phantom of oral burn as well. And all of this comes about because eating is biologically protected behavior. And the brain uses input up the taste nerve to tell itself the organism is eating. So the way taste is wired, the impulses go up one side, cross the cortex, and come down as a series of descending pathways that inhibit. They turn off things incompatible with eating. And the phantoms are just a byproduct of this mechanism. Let me give you an example. If you want to make yourself gag, stick your finger down your throat. Now, when you swallow food, you stimulate all the same receptors, but you don't gag. Why not? Taste input from eating inhibits the gag. But should you develop a disorder of taste, you'll find that you start gagging from eating food. And this is one of the saddest things that happens to cancer patients toward the ends of their lives. Radiation therapy and chemotherapy damage taste. They release inhibition. You gag too much, you have oral pain, you have taste phantoms. These are all characteristic of cancer patients at the end of their life. And now, by understanding this whole thing, we can intervene and we can do something to bring some semblance of quality of life back to these patients. And you can see this is exciting to me because both my father and my brother would have profited by this if we had only known it a little earlier. And I guess I should tell you that the most exciting problem I work on now is actually a measurement theory problem. One of the things that I discovered, oh good Lord, 15 years ago, is that some people are born with many, many more taste buds than others. We call them super tasters. They live in a neon food world compared to, I'm a non-taster, my pastel taste world. Probably they taste things 2-3 times as intense as the rest of us. Has a big impact on what they eat. Eating affects your diet choices. Diet's very important to health. So it turns out now, one of the main things my lab does is to look at the links between genetic variation in the ability to taste and health. And it's mediated through behavior, which I really enjoy enormously. But in order to discover super tasters, we had to do something that hadn't been done really before. We had to be able to compare sensations across people. Now, you and I cannot share consciousness. So how do I know what you're tasting? I don't. The way that is solved in most of the world is you use something like a 9-point scale. 9 is extremely strong, 5 is medium, 1 is very weak, and you assume roughly that very strong is the same to everybody. What if it isn't true? You've got people in one world with a very, very big scale, you've got people in another world with a very, very little scale, and when you compare the numbers on those two scales, they don't tell the truth. You get erroneous comparisons. So we worked out the math of it, and we came up with a better method. I actually did this in 1975, and I didn't know everybody didn't do it this way. You know, I mean, it seemed reasonable. We used a standard from a modality not related to taste. We started with salt, we moved to sound, now we use light. So if I were testing your taste system, I would probably put a pair of earphones on you, and I would play tones of varying loudness, and I would ask you to match the taste I'm giving you to the tone intensity. It's called cross-modality matching. A wonderful psychologist at Harvard proved in the 60s you can do it. And what would happen is, if you have a lot of taste buds, you would match that taste to a much louder tone. In fact, I can give you the exact experiment. If I took people with lots of taste buds and people with very few, and had everybody taste a Coke, and say, tell me how sweet the Coke is from 0 to 100. 100 is the sweetest taste you've ever had. 0 is no sweet at all. Everybody would pick about 2/3 of the way up, about 66, 60, 70, something like that. And they would call it, oh, a little bit more than a medium sweet. Now you put earphones on them, and the ones with the most taste buds will crank that loudness up to 90 decibels, the loudness of a train whistle. The ones with the fewest taste buds will crank it down to the loudness of a dial tone on a phone. That's 80 decibels. And 80 to 90 decibels is a difference of a factor of 2 in loudness. So we know that those groups, one of them will experience twice as much sweet as the other. That's how we discovered super tasters. And that method is not in common use in science. And what I've been doing for the last 10 years of my life is trying to figure out why and trying to get people to use it, because it's the correct way to do comparisons across people. As it is, all of sensory work in medicine is based on these crazy 9-point, 10-point scales. Pain, wonderful example. We did an experiment of pain and light. We asked several hundred people to rate the worst pain they'd ever had and tell us what it was, and to rate the brightest light they'd ever seen. If the women picked childbirth as their worst pain, they rated the childbirth pain as 20% more intense than the brightest light they'd ever seen. The men rated their worst pain as equal to the brightest light they'd ever seen. And so you show that for females who pick childbirth as their worst pain, their pain scale is very large compared to the pain scale of men. You medicate at 4 in hospitals on your 10-point pain scale? Well, 4 is a more intense pain to those women than it is to men. Do we really want to make women have to experience more pain to get medication in a hospital? I don't think so. So I'm trying very, very hard to get people to correct that method.
The taste map that we all learned about when we were in elementary school. So that's wrong, too.
Oh, boy. I didn't discover that. It was discovered by a student, Virginia Collings, of my colleague, Don McBurney. But I translated the German article that led to the misunderstanding so that I knew how it happened. And it's absolutely amazing. The guy who mistranslated the German that led to the myth of the tongue map was Edwin Boring, who was a psychologist at Harvard. I love to tell the story because Edwin Boring wasn't very nice to females at Harvard. Story is he used to make them wait on the porch, and they couldn't come into the building until they came in with a man. Who knows if it's true, but historians tell us that he was not a real nice guy when it came to women. He translated the German wrong. And his mistranslation led to the myth that there was a distribution of the 4 qualities on different parts of the tongue. And a figure that he published in a book in the 1940s was misinterpreted as being a map of the tongue. And it never was. There never was any evidence for it. And one of the things I've enjoyed, because I love talking to kindergartners, you know, little kids about taste, and they get a little older, and they've had biology textbooks, and they've done a tongue map experiment. And so I've asked kids that I lecture to, did you get the picture in the book? And they say, no, we didn't. It didn't come out that way. I say, why do you think that happened? The answer is sobering. We must have done it wrong. Their observations were correct. The book was wrong. And that's something that it's really hard for us to understand.
Well, speaking of kindergartners, what advice would you give a young person interested in a career in science?
You know, I've been given a lot of practical advice in my life, and I will tell you, there is no point doing something you don't love. Do what you love. Because even if you're not an incredible success, you're doing something that you like. All the practical admonitions, you have to have a postdoc, you have to do that. I find those not very persuasive. I really have fun every day. I can barely wait to get into the lab every day. And I'm 70. I think that's nice to feel that way about it. And I don't think I would do anything differently because of where I've gotten to and the fact that I get to do. I sometimes don't want to admit how much fun it is. I'm afraid they'll drop my salary.
Since 1863, the nation's top scientists have been honored with membership in the National Academy of Sciences. Today, there are more than 2,500 in the NAS membership, of whom approximately 200 have won Nobel Prizes. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Interviews and invite you to join us again for another inspiring conversation.